Welcome to the Embodiment Conference. This channel, Trauma and Social Change, it's absolutely the moment for that, isn't it? I'm Steve Hoskinson. I'm the founder of Organic Intelligence. I've been teaching in this area of trauma, embodiment, and social change for about 25 years. It's an honor, really, for us to be sponsoring this channel where we're going to hear a multiplicity of voice, all unique contributors to our collective understanding of how to move from trauma and support then social change. Our unique voice in organic intelligence has something to do with a koan that I'd like to present to you, which is trauma means unintegrated resource. And that's a koan, and if you'd like and are feeling intrigued about that riddle, then tune in to the post-trauma system development course that we are offering here. The coupon code that'll get you half off on that is ENJOY. Now, enjoy this next presentation, and we'll look forward to another meaningful time as we explore these topics, trauma and social change. Enjoy.
So if you want to focus on the uppermost slide there, you can see it says connection, our deepest desire and greatest fear. This is actually the original title of my book, Healing Developmental Trauma. I had to change the title because Random House said that this particular title wasn't Googleable, but it has a lot of meaning for me, and it has a lot of meaning for me in terms of what I'm going to be presenting today about embodiment and how that relates, and shame and guilt, and how shame and guilt and embodiment are so closely connected. And so I could just as easily have substituted embodiment, our deepest desire and greatest fear. And this is possibly a little bit of a different perspective than what you've been getting, because I think there are lots of useful practices that can help embodiment, movement practices, and various kinds of body work and things that are very, you know, can be very effective. And the more effective the techniques are, the more that you're going to actually run into kind of what I call these internal obstacles to embodiment or internal obstacles to connection. And I'm going to talk about that in particular in relationship to shame and guilt here. And it's important for maybe everyone to understand, given the title of this conference, is that one of the most basic concepts in NARM, in the neuroaffective relational model that you can see on the screen, is that we're supporting the development of the embodied adult consciousness. I don't talk about the inner child and a lot of things that in other models that they talk about, but I do talk about this embodied adult consciousness as we work through the various kinds of, you know, internal obstacles, the learned internal obstacles that get in the way of us really being connected to ourselves, to our bodies, to our emotions, and to other people, then we're able to be more and more in contact with our bodies. And obviously that's what this conference is about. And we'll go now to scroll down to the second slide where it shows this, the neuroaffective relational model slide. Yeah. So you can see here I've written, and this is on the book, I put this everywhere because it's such a basic element to the NARM work. And this is that the spontaneous movement in all of us is towards connection, health, and aliveness. We could also add embodiment there. No matter how withdrawn and isolated we have become, or how serious the trauma we have experienced, on the deepest level, just as a plant spontaneously moves towards sunlight, there is in each of us an impulse moving toward connection and healing. And this organismic impulse is the fuel of the NARM approach. Now, That's the other side of the coin. It's the basic element that has to do with that we're in all of us, there is this movement towards re-embodiment, and that's part of what I mean by connection to body, connection to emotion, and the capacity to be in connection with other people. And then there are all of these learned kinds of dynamics that get in the way of that. Now, I know that many of you, as different kinds of somatic therapists out there, have had the experience of working with clients whose access to the body is either very compromised or non-existent. And if you ask them what they're feeling in their body, for example, they can't tell you. And as a matter of fact, even the question itself will make them anxious. So I'm here to help everybody to understand some of what the psychological, emotional, and really psychobiological dynamics are that get in the way of increased connection and increased embodiment. And to do that, we need to have a general understanding of developmental trauma. And I'm going to go to the next slide and give you just a brief overview of the theme of developmental trauma. I don't know if you can make that a little bigger. If possible, that would be ideal. And then it's okay. And we'll go to the very bottom, and then you can scroll up. I just want everybody to be able to see the screen. And it's fine for all of your viewers to get these slides too, so that you'll have them, you know, they can have them to read independently, along with some of the other freebies that I'll be mentioning towards the end of my presentation. But if you look here, this is really an integrated model of both developmental trauma and shock trauma. The shock trauma dynamic is on the right side, and the developmental trauma dynamic is on the left side. And as a result of both kinds of trauma, in the most extreme examples, people use dissociation in order to manage. And part of the dissociative process is to disconnect from the body. So that when you have these clients who come in and are unable to access emotions or sensation, by definition, these are highly traumatized individuals, because the normal state for us as human beings is to be embodied. We disembody, we disconnect from our own body, we dissociate and use other kinds of protective mechanisms in order to live in unbearable situations. And as a matter of fact, when I teach about dissociation, I talk about dissociation, which is that capacity which helps human beings bear the unbearable. So this is very important for all somatic practitioners to understand, that if you make your work goal-oriented to get somebody in their body, you can potentially override some of the protective mechanisms that people have developed that are keeping them out of the body. And for some people, this can actually be re-traumatizing. So I tell all of the people who train with me is it's never our job to get people in their bodies. That's a goal-oriented perspective that ignores that it's also frightening for people to be embodied. All of us to various degrees have disembodied for a reason. And unless we understand those emotional elements to the factors that are keeping us disconnected from our body, and that will include the theme of the today, which is shame and guilt. Unless we pay attention to that, we can actually get ourselves into difficulty, and we can potentially even re-traumatize some of our clients. Because when a client comes in and they're profoundly disembodied, as I said a few minutes ago, they're disembodied for a reason. And I'm going to share some of that, you know, in a very kind of a brief format, since time is limited, about what happens in developmental trauma and how shame and guilt develop, and what that has to do with the theme of embodiment, which is an important theme for me personally in my work, and an important theme, obviously, for this conference. So we see that if we look up the left branch here, we see that at the very bottom, though, there's this core energy or life force. And this core energy life force is given different names in different traditions. I tried to keep it as general as possible to, you know, so there aren't any kind of particular associations with it, but it's that energy or life force that animates us. And as you see that, as there's a, and you can look on the the left side of the screen where it says healthy differentiation of the life force, the written on the vertical. That's up till that those first set of dotted lines. These are just the healthy differentiation of the life force. When you're connected to your body, when you're connected to the life force, you have the capacity for healthy expression of needs. It's experienced when you feel it as strength. It also is the capacity for healthy aggression. And I use healthy because the word aggression has come to be synonymous in some people's mind with anger, and it can be, but that's why I'm talking about healthy aggression, that aggression that helps us deal with the challenges that life brings us. And it's the ability to develop a sense of self and to develop the ability to express our needs and so on. So then in developmental trauma, and you see the next little box says unmet needs / distress, is that when there are unmet needs, that the infant or the small child experiences distress. And then the natural response on the part of the child, this doesn't have to be learned, as any parent knows, this children are built in, have a built-in capacity to express their needs even before words, and they do that in the form of protest. And if it's a pre-verbal experience, this then protest will be just in the form of different kinds of crying or fussing, the various kinds of ways that infants have of to communicate with their caregivers. Now, when they have healthy attuned parenting, the protest is heard by the parent, and he or she or they attune to the protest. And if the baby's cold, then you know, they wrap it up. If the baby's wet, then they change their diapers. If they're hungry, they feed them. If they're sick, they attend to that. So that's what happens when there's attuned caregivers. But for many people, many of us, we start to see that there are basic emotional needs, and I call them in NARM psychobiological needs, that when these basic needs are chronically unmet, in the form of neglect, abuse, all, you know, all kinds of abuse, emotional abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, that the protest amps up into anger and rage. And that's frightening for the child. It's a natural progression of things. It's, again, it's a way of amping up the communication to the environment, but it's threatening for two reasons, one for external reasons and the other for internal reasons. So for some caregivers, if the infant expresses their anger and rage, the caregiver will become enraged. And that, of course, you know, is very threatening to a child. But there's another significant piece, which is a core element of the NARM work, which is what I teach, the neuroaffective relational model, is that anger in itself, anger at the caregivers, is very threatening. And it threatens the loss of the attachment relationship, and it threatens really the loss of love. And it's important to remember that attachment and this need to experience a loving environment, loving caregivers, and the love that the child has for the parents is as basic to the infant as breathing and food and, you know, shelter. It's a basic biological and emotional need, the attachment piece that I'm talking about. And so in order to protect the attachment relationship, the child will begin to foreclose or split off the anger and the rage that they're feeling. And as soon as they start to do that, the process of disembodiment is beginning. Because the only way you can disavow or disconnect from primary emotions is by disconnecting from your body. So you see, here the dissociative disconnecting process is beginning. And the paradox, though, is that they disconnect from themselves in order to protect the attachment relationship. And you know, I always like to communicate a very kind of simple understanding at the beginning here to that I think everybody can relate to, which is to ask yourselves, is it better to be the unlovable child of loving parents or the loving child of parents who are incapable of love? I think most of you will see that how threatening it would be for a child to experience themselves as lovable and but have no hope from getting love from their caregivers. And this is catastrophic for an infant. And so they make the unconscious choice, which has important effects on the body, but they make the unconscious choice to identify as the unlovable child of loving parents. You know, that for one thing, it's the only way that the brain and the mind can work for children is that a child can't experience him or herself or themselves as a good person in a bad situation. So all of these dynamics function to protect the attachment relationship, but we do that at the price of disconnecting from our bodies, our emotions, and other people as well. And you see, then above that threat of the attachment loss box is this splitting projection box. And splitting, I'm using the psychodynamic terminology, which is we literally split the image of the caregiver into the good caregiver and the bad caregiver, and of the self into the good self and the bad self. So here, along with disembodiment, is the beginning of shame. So that to protect the attachment relationship, the child will identify as the bad self, the unloving child. And you see, another point about that is it gives the child hope. If they're bad, then they can just figure out how to be good enough, and then they'll get the love that they need. And so then if you can start to scroll up a little bit, so we can see the acting out and the, yeah, there we go. Yeah, you could go up a little higher and then we can get the old whole upper half in. Perfect. There we go. So you see then at this point, the child has already begun the to disconnect from their bodies and from their emotions. And they're filled with anger and it has no place to go. There's no place safe to deal with it. So they have two options. Some children, a minority of children, but still some children act out the anger. And I mean, there's different ways of acting out. Sometimes it could just be as benign as tantrums, but we know that some children act out against other children, against small animals, and so on. So acting out is one strategy for trying to address and work with the anger that the child feels inside. The more common strategy that children use is to act in the anger against the self. And this is then the beginning of self-hatred, toxic guilt, toxic shame, and it's moving into, notice that this slides, but the part before, the hypervigilance and anxiety and all of that was, these were sympathetically dominant symptoms. Now we're starting to move into more parasympathetically dominant symptoms. For those of you who are maybe, I think probably most of you are familiar with the nervous system, the autonomic nervous system, and the fight-flight response. And the parasympathetically dominant response is the shutdown response. It's the conservation withdrawal response. And that's when the child starts to go into freeze, and freeze that serves to bind this internal conflict in a way and to disconnect it from awareness. But we do so at the price again of being connected to our bodies and our emotions, so that we foreclose access to our body and emotions in order to continue to survive and in order to continue the sense of that there's still the possibility of love in the universe. And so then we see the uppermost box where we see these various kinds of symptoms that are at the more extreme end of the spectrum. They involve dissociation, social isolation, physical symptoms, helplessness, collapse, chronic fear, and toxic shame. And I want to say that in NARM, even though I come from I've been doing somatically oriented psychotherapy for close to 40 years now, the role of the body in NARM is a little bit different than maybe in some ways importantly different than some of the earlier methods that I know and other methods that I think are being practiced today. And that is that the body is the mechanism of disconnection, and that we disconnect from our self and others through tension and or collapse. Tension is the sympathetically dominant response, and then collapse is the parasympathetically dominant response. And as we're doing that, we're getting increasingly disconnected from our bodies. And so then there's a whole range of identifications that children develop about themselves. And to go further into that, I'd like to go into the next slide, please. Right. Okay. And you'll start to see that this process of foreclosure of the self to maintain attachment. And these are always body-based dynamics. So as again, just to repeat, the way we foreclose aspects of the self is by first tensing up and holding our breath and tightening the musculature in our body. And when that goes on too long, that highly aroused, sympathetically dominant state is experienced as dangerous and threatening to the organism. And so to preserve itself, the organism will shut down and go into collapse. So we see that in NARM, I posit five different core needs. And then what happens when the child, it's usually, we're talking about developmentally, we're usually talking about children, although some of these mechanisms, of course, continue into adulthood. But one of the ways the child adapt to the core need of connection, which is when it's not being met, is to foreclose connection, to disconnect from the body and from social engagement. And then you see the strategy to protect the attachment relationship is to give up their very sense of existence, to disconnect, again, to disconnect from body and emotions, and attempt to become invisible. And so I want to clarify this because these individuals with these five core needs are chronologically based, and the survival styles themselves are also developmentally based and chronologically based and bodily based. So for example, the connection survival style, those people who develop this connection survival style as an adaptation have often experienced very early trauma, and that includes prenatal trauma, birth trauma, very early attachment trauma. They've experienced trauma before they ever had the opportunity to embody. And this obviously creates a huge difficulty because in a certain sense, they've never embodied. And they've never had that experience. That's very different, let's say, than somebody who's in a severe car accident, for example, it's a shock trauma. They too can go into profound dissociation and profound disconnection from the body as a way of coping with the trauma and the PTSD that people experience from severe auto accidents, as well as many other sources. And that these individuals, if they've had the experience of embodying early on, they have a place to go back to. But when you're working with these clients who have such early trauma that they've never had the experience of embodiment, since embodiment is our natural state, it's the natural movement towards all of us. That's what that first slide was about. But at the same time, when somebody has never had the experience of being embodied, it's a slower process, and there are elements that are necessary for us to pay attention to be able to facilitate that embodiment process. And I hope that that maybe helps a lot of you practitioners out there to understand why with some clients it's so difficult or even impossible given the tools that you know that some people have to get people into their bodies if you're not able to address what the original reason for disconnecting from the body was in the first place. So then as we move further down developmentally, now let me say this too, is that because these are chronological and developmental, you can imagine then that if you start at the very beginning of life and you never have the opportunity to fully connect either to your caregivers or to your body and emotions, that that's going to have ramifications and implications for all the later survival styles. And that is the case, because obviously if you can't feel your body, you can't feel your emotions, it's going to be harder to then to know what it is you need. And this second survival style, which is the attunement survival style, is around awareness of our needs. And you can see that the way that when, now these individuals who develop primarily the attunement survival style, they have embodied to some degree. They often have the experience, though, of early loss of some kind or another, or early separations. Or it can just be growing up in a family where there's really chronic misattunement to basic emotional and biological needs. But whatever the causes are, the child manages and survives via the mechanism of disconnecting from the experience of and the expression of personal needs. And often you can see as part of the survival style dynamic is that they give up their own needs in order to focus on the needs of others, particularly the needs of the parents. I talk about an energetic reversal, and some people talk about the parentification of children, where the children actually ends up being the caretaker to the parent. But to do so, again, they have to disconnect from their needs, which means ultimately that they have to disconnect from their body. So the next survival style has to do with trust. Again, when your dependency and your trust needs are used against you in a variety of ways, as you can see here, children give up their authenticity in order to be who the parents want them to be. To be the parent's best friend, to live out the dream that the parent never fulfilled for themselves. And again, part of the adaptive mechanism is always a disconnection mechanism. So all of these core needs and survival adaptations are expressions of disconnection. And one of the primary things that we disconnect from is the body. And along with that, of course, emotional awareness. We disconnect from our emotions, again, by tensing, collapsing, and foreclosing awareness. And these are all bodily-based mechanisms. So then we see that we've got the autonomy survival style, and the basic need that's not recognized here in some families is the child's need to develop healthy autonomy. And this can be for a variety of reasons from on the part of the parents that either, you know, some parents feel abandoned as their child starts to develop increasing autonomy. Other kinds of family atmospheres where when the parent always knows what's best, or when the parents are very intrusive, when they don't recognize the child's boundaries, all of these dynamics, which I don't have the time to, you know, to fully develop here, start getting in place. And so what we see then as the survival adaptation is that children give up direct expressions of independence in order not to feel abandoned or crushed or invaded. Okay. And then the final survival style has to do with love and sexuality. You notice it's the only survival style with the two names. because these are the two basic needs and ultimately the two basic capacities when they develop. But in some families, again, the child, again, the developmental themes are complex, and I won't have the time to go into it in great detail, but just suffice it to say that the child, for a variety of reasons, feels the need to foreclose their feelings of love and their heart connection to their parents. In some families, which are very, you know, let's say, either ignorant of, you know, choose to be ignorant of a child's sexuality because it's threatening to them, or growing up in an atmosphere which is very prudish and very, you know, critical towards children's bodies, or when children start to explore their genitals, the whole process that they, the children learn very early on from both direct and indirect messages to foreclose their sexuality. Well, of course, you foreclosing your sexual feelings as well as your heart is means that you have to disconnect from your sexuality. It means you have to disconnect from your body. You have to disconnect from your genitals, and you have to disconnect from your heart. And in NARM, I talk about the importance of, there's a third step here, which is that some people can have access to their heart, other people have more access to their sexuality, but there's a third sub-phase in the development here where people learn to be able to integrate love with sexuality. And to do that means that you have to be fairly far along on the embodiment scale to be able to experience that kind of integration, because it requires a certain bodily awareness that for many people, because of their adaptation to developmental trauma, has become foreclosed. Okay, let's go into the next slide, please. Okay, so here I'm getting to the theme of shame and guilt, and particularly in this part, the shame. And so that part of the disconnection process, it's shame is both a symptom of disconnection and a driver of disconnection at the same time. So, for example, if the connection survival style, when they don't feel welcomed into the world for whatever reasons, it can be, again, from a lack of attachment, you know, the caregiver doesn't have the capacity for a healthy attachment themselves, so they can't offer that to the child. Sometimes from very early surgeries or very long and traumatic births, there can be, or intergenerational trauma that falls into the category of prenatal trauma. All of these elements can come together, and so that the child actually ends up feeling shame at existing. And they end up feeling like a burden, and they can live their whole lives with the feeling that they just don't belong anywhere. And again, to manage all of this requires profound disconnection from the body, which creates its own symptoms. Now, just again for your awareness that there are also these pride-based counter-identifications that people develop. And they, though they feel better, because it, you know, for example, rather than feeling like you don't belong, there's the pride-based counter-identification of the individuals who take pride in being a loner. Or like feeling like your needs are a burden on people, then that's the shame-based identification. The pride-based counter-identification is the feeling of pride in not needing others. Well, or the same thing with emotions. Often individuals with the connection survival style don't feel emotions in the same way that that people who haven't experienced early trauma feel it, because they've needed to disconnect from them in order to survive. So that's, they feel shame about that initially, but the pride-based counter-identification is that they take pride in not being emotional. And they'll look at other human beings and say, oh, all those other human beings with all these messy emotions. And you see, there's two, I'm going to give a little more attention to this one because it's so directly connected to the theme of the conference, that there are actually two subtypes in the NARM model for two subtypes of ways of managing this profound early disconnection. One I call the thinking subtype, And for them, the energy and awareness is basically in, is drawn out of the body and into the head. And the pride-based and the well, the thing that they tell themselves consciously or unconsciously is that as long as I stay in my head and can figure things out, then I'm safe. And of course, you know, all of these survival mechanisms have worked to a certain degree, otherwise we wouldn't survive. But we pay a big price for that, obviously, because to live in our heads, we have to live disconnected lives, disconnected from our emotions, disconnected from our bodies. And really, if we're stuck in our heads, we're not going to be very capable of being closely connected with other people. And so the other subtype in this is what I call the spiritualizing subtype. And I don't mean all spiritual people when I'm talking about this. I'm talking about people who use what sometimes is called spiritual bypass. And these individuals don't live in the body at all. They live in the energetic field. So they, again, and they often have capacities to be connected energetically and to really to spiritual states, and some of them real states, but they're bypassing their bodily experience. They never embody on the planet. They can live in a more ethereal world, but they have a hard time being in their bodies and being on the planet. And it's just important for every practitioner out there to remember that these are all protective mechanisms. These dynamics of disconnection are protective mechanisms that we all have used to one degree or another. And these are part of the challenges to increased embodiment for all of us. So as we go down, I'll look at this list of some of the other shame-based identifications. So the shame-based identification for the attunement survival cells, they feel needy, they feel unfulfilled, they feel empty, they feel undeserving, you know, so they try to make again, a child will try to make sense of the distress that they experience and the difficult situation that they find themselves in. And so this is again an example is that as the child's psychology or psychological self develops more and more, they will come up with these identifications that try to make sense of the pain that they're experiencing. So in their mind, the shame-based identification is to feel undeserving. Now there are a whole bunch of pride-based counter-identifications that I'll let you look at on your own time, but just because time is limited here, I'm not going to go through all of these pride-based counter-identifications, but just know that for every shame-based identification, there's a pride-based counter-identification. And actually, even though they make us feel better, these pride-based counter-identifications disconnect us even one step further. So then we see, as we go down to the autonomy survival style, this shame about, we're really about any authentic self-expression, particularly saying no or setting limits is difficult for them. They are angry. They feel angry at not having their autonomy supported, but they feel ashamed, and they feel bad to whatever degree that they're even aware of their anger. Other kinds of elements that you see is that are more hidden and would require more time to explain than I have here today. So just suffice it to say that the primary shame is really about this core need, which is to develop your own sense of autonomy. And then the love sexuality survival style, they're you know, they feel deeply hurt, wounded in the heart. They feel rejected. They often feel physically flawed and they feel unloved and unlovable. And every one of these identifications in NARM is held differently than how the term identification is used in both spiritual systems that I'm familiar with, as well as the few systems, psychological systems that talk about identifications. Because in NARM, every identification is a psychobiological process. In other words, there's no mental construct that doesn't have a physiological aspect to it. And it's what I was talking about before, is that these identifications are held in the body in the form of tension and or collapse. And with the connection survival style, where there's the earliest trauma before the musculature is developed, because most of us, we know that we can hold our breaths and tense our muscles, and we do that consciously or unconsciously as a way of trying to manage our emotions and to manage stress. But for infants who are born without this capacity, the mechanism of contraction is even deeper. The contraction is in the organ systems and in the central nervous system. This obviously presents, this creates profound physiological dysregulation, really, of the central nervous system, the autonomic nervous system, but really all of the systems of the body can become dysregulated. And it helps you understand why so many individuals with this connection survival style experience various kinds of syndromes, psychological syndromes like anxiety and depression, and physiological syndromes such as irritable bowel syndrome, chronic fatigue, so many different ways that the body is involved in this process. And I don't use the word somaticized because it sounds like that's a psychological process that then gets put into the body. And in NARM, it's much more subtle than that, that they are at the same time cognitive mental processes top down and physiological processes bottom up. And in NARM, I teach people how to work with both of these elements simultaneously. Okay, if we could go on. Next one now. So I presented this information in this book, Healing Developmental Trauma. That's actually the second book that I was the co-writer of. The first book was on PTSD, and below I'm going to show you my a new book that's just come out. But before I talk about the book, I want just to say a few more things about shame and this vicious cycle of disconnection causing shame and shame causing disconnection. Because as I think we all know on some level, that to experience shame is a very painful state. And we do what we can to disconnect from these basic feelings of badness and worthlessness and being a burden and so on. And the mechanism that we use is always a bodily based mechanism. And that includes disconnecting from our emotions as well. So I've developed then what I call the neuroaffective relational model, which I present in this book, which is that, as I touched on briefly, it's a bottom up and top down simultaneous working with this body mind dynamic, the psychosoma dynamic. Dynamic, sorry. And the important thing I think for that I want to communicate to a whole variety of practitioners that I know are present in this conference is that we can't just get people into their bodies without dealing with the shame and all of the other elements that I've just had, a minimal amount of time to address. It puts people in an impossible situation. They believe that they want to get in their bodies, and some people will come to you as a somatic practitioner and say, "I've come to you because I want to feel more of my body," and that's fine. That is their deepest desire. All of our deepest desire is to live in our body, to be connected to ourself and to others, but it's also their greatest fear. And that's the piece that we need to pay attention to, because if we are protecting ourselves by living in a disconnected, unfeeling state, despite that, it feels safer than starting to feel. And in the book, I talk about the challenges of reconnection and how we work with, all of these various elements of and strategies that disconnect us. And it's a slower, it's not something that can be done in one or two sessions for most people. This is something that takes a little bit of time. Now, I think that I'm not talking about, psychoanalysis that takes 20 years, but particularly when there's been the very earliest kind of trauma, when I was talking about the connection survival style, it takes some time for people to learn how to work with, address, and understand and release the various kinds of patterns and dynamics that they learned to protect themselves. And one of, and the big picture is disconnection from the body. But we have to look at many of the small pictures that go up, that go into the formation of that, that larger disconnect that people experience. Now, also in the training, if I had another couple of hours here, I do have a particular protocol for helping people reconnect to their bodies, which includes doing the emotional work that I'm talking about that's so necessary here. So as you can see, I know we've got, you guys have done an amazing job with all these simultaneous translation channels that you've got going on. And I just want people to know that the book, Healing Developmental Traumas, in English, German, Danish, Spanish, French, Italian, Czech, you can read Polish, Greek, Chinese, soon to be published in Turkish and Japanese. And to my Dutch friends, I apologize, I left you off the list because it's also in Nederlands or Dutch. So that was my second book. And then the third book is the next one below, if you can just go down there. This one is now out in, just came out in German. It's being translated into English and then will be translated from English into other languages shortly. But this one is Freeing Oneself from Shame and Guilt, which is interestingly enough, the title of my presentation here today. And in it, and my co-writer, Angelika Duna, we take a great deal of time and really write for the general public as well as for therapists, the various dynamics of shame and guilt, which I've had just the opportunity to touch on here today. But we do address very specifically how shame and guilt affect embodiment and how ultimately, as we work through the shame and guilt and the other learned difficulties, that there is this increasing embodiment, and it takes us to what I started off with at the very beginning of the session, which was talking about the oh, I somehow I started I got ahead of myself was that I completely lost my thread there. I was looking at the title and reading the title, and I lost whatever it was that I was going to say. But so I was talking about shame and guilt.
I love
About the embodied adult consciousness. There it is. That's what I was looking for. So, and now if you'll take it to the next slide, this will maybe be the slide that will interest many of you. You'll see that we've got several free gifts for people. And if you just click on to this particular link there, www.normtraining.com, Embodiment Conference, we've got some special gifts for you. Including some time to be able to take a look at the NARM Inner Circle. And you can read some of the things that we present on the Inner Circle. We have demonstration videos, and all of these demonstration videos are accompanied by a transcript and then a debrief on my part or on my teacher and partner in the NARM Institute, Brad Kammer. He and I do the debrief of each one of these sessions. There's calls every month. There's a live topic every month, sometimes about specifically around embodiment. There's a NARM ebook. You have access to a discussion forum and access to 3 months of material from our archives.
Thank
So I
you.
hope that I hope that everybody will click on and take a look and take advantage of the free offer. And Again, it's a short amount of time to present a complex topic, but thank you for your attention, everybody, and thank you to the organizers for setting all of this up and making it possible.
Thank you for incredibly sophisticated work there. I think it's one of those talks that needs listening to a few times, I think, to fully digest. We didn't get around to questions, but if people want to discuss with each other, you can do that in the breakout rooms. I think one of the sort of best features of the conference is those rooms where you can chat to other people and sort of share your experience and chat it over. If you like this one, we have many other trauma teachers still to come. So you may have caught Basil van der Kolk, that's still available for free. Stephen Porges is tomorrow. There's many, many other great, great teachers in the trauma channel. So I, you know, recommend taking a look at what's there. As ever, the full library is available if you want to sort of not feel rushed and digest it in your own time, long after the conference has gone. So we're going to play our sponsor video actually at the end today. So let me go back to Lawrence for a final word. Lawrence, we normally ask for our one sentence top tip. We're going to put these together in a book. So do you have a top tip for us to close?
I do, which is to be aware of the importance of embodiment, but not to try and push it to work with the obstacles and the fear of embodying as much as you work with whatever practices that support embodiment.
Thank you very much for joining us today.